Heyo, good morning. Hi, Nexus. I'm Kim, and this morning I'm excited to share with you some thoughts about the theme of prison in the Book of Acts. These are both thoughts that are my own, as well as some from good old theologian Willie Jennings, who we've been wrestling with and learning from a bunch over the past several weeks. There are a couple reasons why I'm really interested in this theme. The first being that I actually have spent a lot of time reading the Book of Acts. As a teenager, I was part of a competitive Bible quizzing team, and the competition that I enrolled in was about the Book of Acts. So we memorized the book and then drove a long way to these various tournaments where we would have our little buzzers and answer our questions and buzz our way to Bible nerd victory. So yeah, spent a lot of time thinking about that book. But as I'm reading Jennings now, I'm realizing that I kind of missed the point back in the day. I think Jennings says, and I totally agree, that the theme of the book is that God is perpetually widening things and saying, hey, it's bigger than you thought. There's more love than you thought. The club is actually for everyone. It's also for Gentiles. It's not just for the religious elite. It's for people who feel like don't have it together, maybe even people on the other side of the law. Spoiler alert, as we'll talk about today. So I really find that theme interesting, considering I missed it the first time around. And another reason why I'm interested in this specific theme of prison in the Book of Acts is that I do spend a lot of time in federal prison. And that's because I have toured a play that went to prisons all across Canada and volunteered in a prison and worked for a year as a behavioral counselor. And then after that, spent quite a few years directing theater in prisons. And so through all these experiences, I've come to really care about the people who are involved in all different ways in the correctional system. I really care about the well-being of incarcerated people. And so I'm just curious to dig into Acts and to learn and think together. So let's do that, right? Okay, so we're gonna start with Acts 5, verse 18 to 42, which you'll remember Melissa covered for us a few weeks ago. So I'll just do a brief recap. We've got Paul and Silas, our protagonists, in prison for preaching the gospel. They are not having a good time. They've been whipped. It's not good. But then jailbreak, the angel of the Lord comes and lets them out. And then they get dragged back into prison and then they're let out again. So what I think is so interesting about this is how God's just like, nope. And so what Jennings says is, the prison claims a God-given right to exist. It claims the right to establish order and control as a fundamental tool of worldly authorities and governments. God takes back this power. The power to free people from bondage is the new order. So Jennings says, and I agree, that in this story, God's turning the power structure on its head. I think when Jennings says the prison claims a God-given right to exist, he's speaking to the fact that as a society, we don't really question the necessity of prison, of our justice system, of our policing system being the way it is, because we just think it's always been that way, and maybe it has to be. It's hard to imagine things being different, perhaps until maybe recently for some of us. And prison, I mean, it seems not only normal, but it seems essential, right? Prison is very powerful as a system. When you're inside, it feels omnipotent, omnipresent. But in this story, God's like, prison bars? Nope, we're not going to do it that way this time. And something is possible that I'm sure the people in the story thought was impossible. It kind of makes me wonder about what else is possible. Like, maybe the spirit of the love of God would have a different vision for what's possible for incarcerated folks in our modern times as well. Revolutionary idea, a little wacky. I know that some people understandably might be thinking like, whoa, 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 whoa. In this story, yes, Paul and Silas are missionaries. They're innocent. They should go free. But the murderers and drug dealers and thieves should stay in prison and do their time. They've got to pay for what they've done, right? And I totally understand that perspective. And I want to say I'm not saying the opposite. Like, my point is not let every prisoner everywhere go free right this very moment. There should be no consequences for people's actions. That's not what I'm saying. But what I do want to say is the idea that it's important for us to complicate the narrative. The narrative that prisoner is bad, justice system is good, because in reality, there's a lot more nuance than that, right? Jennings, he's got a neat quote that I'd like to read a passage. So he writes, "Incarceration and prisons have constantly been placed right in the middle of moral discourse about right and wrong, good and evil, innocence and guilt, crime and punishment. People do bad or horrible things. Yes, this is an irrefutable fact. And people go to prisons. This too is irrefutable. But there is no direct connection between these two facts. Indeed, when we collapse these two statements into each other in our thinking, we lose sight of the horror that is prison. And we also forget that horrible things are being done every day for which no one is being held accountable. The point is that there is space between the truth that people do wrong and horrible things and the truth that people go to prison. The disciples of Jesus live in that space because that's where God has chosen to be seen and known. We serve a God who was arrested, convicted, and sentenced. We must reflect deeply on this fact. Jesus was found guilty. We may, from our vantage point, claim his innocence, but such a view was absent at his incarceration and trial. Perhaps we need to remember that who gets arrested, charged, tried, and convicted is very often a matter of who has access to resources or who enters a judicial process already profoundly disadvantaged. The question is not, can a judicial or prison system be moral, but rather, how must a disciple of Jesus give witness to its need and the beginning of a new way of life together?" Whoa, good question, Jennings, right? Okay, let's hop back into the book of Acts, this time chapter 16, verse 25. "At about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly there was a violent earthquake which shook the prison to its foundations. All at once the doors opened and the chains fell off all the prisoners. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he thought that the prisoners had escaped, so he pulled out his sword and was about to kill himself. But Paul shouted at the top of his voice, 'Don't harm yourself. We are all here.' The jailer called for a light, rushed in, and fell trembling at the feet of Paul and Silas. Then he led them out and asked, 'Sirs, what must I do to be saved?' They answered, 'Believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved, you and your family.' Then they preached the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in the house. At that very hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. He and all of his family were baptized at once. Then he took Paul and Silas up into his house and gave them some food to eat. He and his family were filled with joy because they now believed in God." Huh, interesting story, right? Very dramatic. You can probably imagine it like a movie with lots of rubble, this earthquake, oh my goodness. I also find it really interesting to think about the symbolism of the line, the prison foundations were shaken, the foundation of the prison is being shaken or questioned. And in this story, we have the chains coming off Paul and Silas and the other prisoners, all of them, and the jailer. Interesting. So in this story, we can imagine the jailer poised with his knife and he stops. I mean, at that moment, maybe he had been thinking that all of the other prisoners who perhaps he had treated quite poorly were going to get vengeance on him. So he wanted to end it first. Or maybe that the system would get him in trouble for letting this happen. So he wanted to be the one to not have that happen to him and to be in control. Either way, I think he's afraid, and he's part of this system that's bigger, this cycle of violence that's bigger than he is, that he doesn't seem to know how to get out of without more violence. It happens. And so I guess his question, "What must I do to be saved?" is really powerful. We hear it all throughout the book of Acts, but it's really interesting to me to hear that question from his social location. And it feels to me like it resonates with all of us who maybe notice that we have at times been part of a system that was part of controlling or oppressing other people. And we are asking ourselves with the jailer, "What must I do to be saved from this cycle of violence?" And I think at first, it's pretty important to realize that we do need to be saved, right? Jennings writes, "The deliverance of the captives must include the jailer, because redemption must come to him if the prisoners are to be set free. Those who are aligned to the technology of the prison must be shown the new order of life in the spirit if they would imagine life beyond cell and chain." So as people of faith, maybe our allegiance shouldn't be to the technology of the prison, but to the possibility of the Spirit doing something different, something restorative. And we're invited to join in that liberation. So, okay, I'm not allowed to share very much, obviously, from my time working in prisons because of confidentiality, but suffice to say that I've witnessed some really beautiful moments of connection, healing, and growth, as well as moments of terrible violence and hate. Both staff and inmates are capable of good and evil. It might sound overly simplistic, but if I've learned anything in prison, it's that hurt people, and we are all in need of liberation. Thankfully, I've also seen that being open to doing things differently, breaking out of those us-them dichotomies that keep us apart, reaching out to the other, that stuff's pretty neat, holy even. If we believe that God's in the business of setting people free, which I think I do, this is what I'm thinking, is that one way that this is happening in our justice system is through something called restorative justice. And I'm pretty in love with this concept. You may be quite familiar with it. If so, if you'll humor me as I give a bit of a recap of its history as well as its main principles. So it's important to note that Indigenous communities have been using restorative approaches basically forever, but did you know that the modern day restorative justice movement actually started really close to home in Elmira, and now it's spread all over the world as officially part of correctional systems, not only here in Canada, but in at least 50 other countries. So in 1974, a young probation officer in Elmira named Mark Yancey found himself responsible for two young offenders who had gone on a vandalism spree all across town. So it was bad. They caused significant grief, significant financial repercussions. Many property owners were affected. So rather than doing the normal thing of like off to jail with you right away, Mark came up with the idea of having the youth actually go door to door and speak with their victims to take responsibility for their actions and apologize and see if they could make things right. So this idea for Mark, the parole officer, came from his Mennonite faith. And the idea of accountability and apologizing and working to make things right, it's maybe not that complicated, but this was the first time that had been officially used as part of a sentence. Mark was working with a judge who was open-minded and said, okay, sure, go for it. And Mark accompanied these two young men up and down the streets of Elmira talking to the people that they had harmed. So these young men learned about how the vandalism had caused people to no longer feel safe at home. They heard about the frustrating insurance battles and how people couldn't get everything covered. And apparently the victims were really thankful for this chance to chat. Often victims want to know why this happened. And so, it was beneficial for them to have some closure and for them to see that these young men actually really now deeply understood the impact of their actions and were remorseful and were working to change, and turn things around. So it was, considered to be really a success, and this style of working became more and more common and grew into the modern day restorative justice movement. Pretty neat, right? So often when people think about restorative justice, they think of victim offender mediation, and this is definitely a really powerful form of restorative justice. You can read about cases where people, even in extreme cases such as murder, perhaps victims and offenders can come together and really learn from each other and really have some reconciliation. Of course, there are many different kinds of restorative justice. Restorative justice processes are deeply personal. They can vary depending on context, and they might occur, say, instead of the traditional justice system, or during it, or after it, like maybe after someone's already spent time in prison, or during that time. There's lots of different ways to do it, but whatever the process looks like, the philosophy is the same. The idea is that crime isn't just breaking rules, it's breaking relationships. To better understand restorative justice, okay, it can be helpful to distinguish what questions it seeks to answer as opposed to what questions the traditional justice system seeks to answer. So we know the traditional justice model asks, what was the rule? Who broke it? What's the punishment? Right? And this can work really well sometimes as a response to crime. Sometimes, though, this framing can miss the context, so the social or political or an economic context in which that rule was broken. And it can also leave the person who was victimized out of the equation. Sometimes a victim is quite happy to see the offender be put away, but other times it doesn't really seem like enough. It doesn't really seem like healing to people. Sometimes victims want to understand why the offense happened, and they want to know that the offender understands the impact of their actions and that they will no longer cause harm. So because of this, restorative justice asks different questions. Restorative justice asks, who's been hurt? What do they need? Who's responsible to meet those needs? And how can we work to make things as right as possible? Interesting, right? So we know that we can't go back to the way things were before the crime or the harm happened, but perhaps there are things that offender, the state, maybe even the victim or their supporters could do to work together to make things as right as possible. A common misconception is that restorative justice is easy on crime, that it's just letting offenders off the hook. But I think many people would agree that this is not the case. Many offenders who have gone through restorative justice processes would say that looking at their victim in the eye was harder than all of those years of prison. You'll remember in the biblical story, the jailer washes Paul and Silas's wounds. That's intense, right? He is intimately aware of the harm that he has caused. Accountability like that can be uncomfortable, maybe even excruciating for the offender, but this that kind of firsthand acknowledgement of the harm that can bring healing, sometimes real healing for both parties. In the story, after the wound washing comes the bread baking. They eat together, right? The jailer shares a feast with Paul and Silas. I really don't think that these two things could have happened in the opposite order. So while I certainly am passionate about the well-being of all the people in our correctional systems, I know that's not necessarily everyone's thing. And so I thought it would also be interesting to think about other things that we need to be set free from. So maybe we need to be set free from social media algorithms and unrealistic standards of appearance. Maybe we need to really think about how we can set our community free from the snare of racism, from economic inequality. In these situations, how are we the prisoner? How are we the jailer? How do we join God in shaking the prison foundations, working for everyone's liberation? What needs to happen for us to get to the point in the story where the jailer has helped wash Paul and Silas's wounds and we're feasting together? I don't know. I mean, there's a lot to think about in there. I don't have the answers, but I am excited to continue pondering these things together in spiritual community. I think also, if I may add a few more points, because I have a lot of thoughts on all this, that another really interesting thing is how we can apply restorative justice principles to our personal lives, not just the systemic, but our families and our communities. So for example, we can really ask those questions: who was hurt? What do they need? Who's responsible to meet those needs? And how do we make things as right as possible? In our personal relationships, say for example, with kids. I mean, I am not a parent. I have seen enough as a social worker with kids, knowing that it's really hard to be a parent. And so I'm not saying I know what I'm talking about, but if there are kids in your life that you care about, I wonder if the idea of restorative discipline might be worth a Google. Basically, the idea in a nutshell, though there's lots to read about it, is that we it's the same thing, right? It's not just about rules, it's about relationships. And so rather than a kid in trouble, it's a kid in struggle. And how do we help that person understand the impacts of their actions and the way that it has harmed their relationships? How do we help them learn to listen when other people are harmed and work to make things as right as possible? And I know teachers and parents who do restorative justice mini circles with kids where they pass the talking stick and talk about harms and needs, and it's really cool. And that also gets me thinking, like, what about for us, the so-called adults? Does it work? Does it work for us, for adult relationships with our friends, with our partners? I think yes. I think sometimes the temptation is that we want to use punishment in our close relationships when we're hurt. So for example, I'm thinking maybe a spouse said something that hurt the other person, and then the response that we want to say as that hurt person is a cold shoulder, or you go sleep on the couch, or some other way of punishing that person, because we want them to feel pain because we're feeling pain. We want them to understand, feel what we're feeling, feel our pain. But of course, they're not really feeling our pain, right? When we punish people, they're feeling a different kind of pain. And that pain might cause them to be defensive or feel misunderstood and angry and like it's unfair. And that might get in the way of them understanding the harm that's been caused and the needs that we have. And so, although it's easier said than done, being really honest when we're harmed about how we're feeling and what we need, and then being able to listen to our partners or friends share that kind of information with us and work together to make things as right as possible, I think there's a lot of wisdom there. I'm also thinking about forgiveness and how sometimes in Christian circles, it's like, you gotta forgive right away sort of thing. And sometimes people think that restorative justice is just about forgiveness, but really it's not just robotic or automatic, right? Because if forgiveness is forced, then the person who's been harmed might feel like there's some lingering resentment there. And also the person who caused the harm might not really understand that they caused the harm and then therefore, or how bad it was. And therefore this problem might keep happening again, right? So those are just some things that I'm thinking about when I think of restorative justice principles in our personal relationships. Of course, I am a human in messy human relationships. I don't have it figured out, but I think that there's a lot of really interesting stuff to think about in there. I'm also thinking about our communities. So even maybe our church communities, I think it's interesting to think about how a community, a group like a church, it's inevitable that we're going to hurt each other. That's just a tricky human thing that we do. And so how do we respond in those situations? How do we hold people accountable when they cause harm? And then maybe also welcome them back in a safe way for reintegration and reconciliation. I'm thinking of an extreme example of a congregation that I was privileged to witness some conversations that people were having where they were debating whether they would be able to welcome someone who had offended and was getting out of prison into their church. And after a lot of discernment, this congregation decided that they needed to make a safe church policy to keep the vulnerable individuals in their congregation safe. And then they were able to welcome this person to attend church. And they even assigned them specific friends to look out for them and then also keep them accountable. And so, I mean, while this might be an extreme example, I think it's really interesting to think about, how we do harm and reconciliation in church, and whether it's through a formal process with a mediator and a talking circle, like for a really serious situation, or whether it's just ourselves in our head asking ourselves these questions. I think the same four questions that I keep coming back to, I know I'm a broken record, are really quite interesting. So in our community, maybe even in our church, like if a harm comes up, maybe we could ask ourselves, like, who's been hurt? What do they need? Who's responsible to meet those needs? And how do we work together to make things as right as possible? Something to think about. Okay, so of course, this is all just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to restorative justice. There are many more resources and ideas that I could point folks to if they're interested. I just would like to say thank you to everyone for listening to my prison and restorative justice themed musings. I wish you grace and peace and maybe a little prison foundation shaking, reconciliation, wound washing, and feasting as well. Thanks for listening. Bye.